and welcome to Root Causes, the PKI and security podcast where a pair of industry veterans talk about all matters PKI, including digital certificates, trust models, hashing algorithms, and things along those lines. I am Tim Callen, senior fellow at Sigtigo, and I'm joined by Jason Sirocco, CTO of IoT at Sigtigo. How are you doing today, Jay?
Great, Tim. I tell you, though, I'm tired after reading all this news.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. So this is episode 30, and we've decided what we need to do for this episode is catch you guys up on a bunch of news, some of which we've been tracking and some of which is new. So why don't we start off with fines for violations for breaches that ultimately could have been solved by better certificate management. So I think the first one on our list is British Airways. So we covered the British Airways breach back in our episode 12, and the fine has been announced, and BA is going to be fined for 1.5% of their annual revenue, which equates to 183 million pounds sterling.
Geez, Tim, that's a lot. And I think what it's showing is GDPR really is starting to get some teeth here. It's a significant number.
Yeah. So GDPR, right? You know, when GDPR came out, they announced that they would fine companies up to 4% of revenue. And, you know, if you think about that, that's just shocking. Even this 1.5%, which is, you know, only a third of what it could be, is amazingly high and definitely could be the difference between profit and loss for many companies.
I think that, as they would say in the financial business, a material hit, and that'll definitely capture the attention of the shareholders. We already know about some of the GDPR fines given to the social media companies. I think some of those are perhaps less surprising. I think if you were to ask shareholders of Google and Facebook about GDPR fines, they might claim that it's either the cost of doing business or it's the principle of the thing, or they might say something like that. But for BA, you know, their operating margins aren't quite what Google's is, that's for sure.
Yeah. So for a huge, highly profitable tech company, you might figure that some amount of fines are just a cost of doing business and you might build that into your budget. But if you want to talk about a market with price pressure, an industry with price pressure, let's talk about the commercial airline industry, right? There is no extra money to be had in that industry. So giving up 183 billion pounds, giving up 1.5% of your revenue has got to be devastating to a company like that.
Well, geez, a few pennies on the price of oil makes a difference for these companies, never mind 1.5% of your revenue.
Yeah, so that is huge. Now, before we get too deep into this topic, let's bring in the next one, which is Equifax. So we all remember in 2017, the Equifax breach cost 147 million Americans, myself included, their PII. And under those circumstances, you know, that was considered to be really bad. And I think people knew that a fine was coming. And so the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, has announced that the Equifax fine will be somewhere between $575 million and $700 million.
Yeah, again, that's really significant. I think that people knew that a big fine was coming. And so a big fine just showed up. And, you know, I think for the implications, though, of, and I think with the rest of some of the news items are interesting in, Tim, is $700 million fine, but it's not over.
Yeah.
You know, the social implications of so many people's PII being out there, your ability to attest yourself for a credit instrument and translate it into English, what I mean is, if you're going to bank to get a loan,
yeah,
how do you declare that you're yourself? Or the flip side of it is, how easy is it now for the bad guy to claim that they're you? And I think it's just getting easier and easier. And I think some of these other news items that we might cover here today, Tim, it's just showing just how difficult this is getting.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me just quickly plug, if you want to hear more about the Equifax breach, listen to our episode 2, because we go into it in more detail. And if you want to hear more about the British Airways breach, listen to our episode 12, because we go into detail there on both of those. But either way, yeah, these are, you know, what happens when one half of the people in the country, it was 45% of the people in America, lose their PII? I mean, that's just so, that fundamentally, is that not affecting, or does that not have the potential to affect the basic fabric of your society? Like how business is done at a fundamental level.
Yeah. 45% of a very large country's population, of which there's probably a good percentage of that population that doesn't even have a bank account anyway. And so therefore, what's the percentage of people who actually are banked,
if right.
you want to call it that? It's probably even a higher percentage.
Absolutely, right? Because sure, exactly. There are children and other yeah. people are part of the population, and they, you know, they have social security numbers, but they don't have income, right? And they don't have money, but they do have social security numbers. So yeah. So let's move on to our next item then. I mean, we talk about 45% of the population. What about more than that? So the news just broke that in the country of Bulgaria, every or virtually every tax ID possessing citizen in the country has had their PII stolen. So the government database was hacked, and 5 million people lost their PII. Now that might not sound big compared to the Equifax breach, but there are 7 million people in the country of Bulgaria. So that's 70%. That's, you know, that's more than 70% of the people in the country having their fundamental tax ID and their personal information owned by online thieves.
So I guarantee there's a lot of people from Bulgaria, Bulgarian citizens who are living all over the EU, mm-hmm. Could be in the UK, could be all over the place. And all those people probably have, you know, split their taxation that they pay to different countries. The complication of if somebody's stealing your identity, especially if you're, you know, working in a foreign country and you're Bulgarian, I just feel so sorry for all of them. Again, but Bulgarians go off and get credit instruments and loans and credit cards just the way we do. The ability for a bad guy to now imitate you want to call it child's play, but it's becoming that. For an entire country, that's serious business, Tim.
So yeah, what do you do? So if you're in the charge of, if you're in governmental leadership at Bulgaria, do you need to be asking yourselves questions like, should we try to issue everybody a new tax ID number? And how do you even go about doing that?
I've got my own news item here on that.
Okay, just, go ahead.
I think this is dated June 20th, which is not that long ago, but Desjardins Group, said that a former employee shared the personal information of more than 2.9 million of its members.
Jeez.
And what's the number? 173,000 business members. So it's a big Canadian bank.
Yeah.
The male suspect was detained, is no longer in custody. I mean, the story goes on and on. Suffice to say that this did include Canadian social insurance numbers. Okay. And the news item that happened just recently, Tim, was exactly what you just said, which is the government convened a special parliamentary committee to ask the questions of the implications of this. Because when the news release from Desjardins Group first came out, they said the usual things, right? We respect the privacy of our customers. We're going to do better. We'll help you with your credit report. Yeah, all those kinds of things. And then the government just asked the question, is this good enough? What are we going to do? And some of the questions that were asked in the parliamentary committee were, is it even possible to start over again with new social insurance numbers for these people? The answer came back, we're not sure. Probably not.
Yeah, incredibly hard. I mean, incredibly hard. Not only think about all of the databases in every place where these things are stored, right? Think about all of the, you know, if you're an employee, then you've got to get that new number to your employer, and every single employee needs to do that, and every employer needs to swap out all of their records. If you have a tax preparer, then they've got to swap out that out. If you're any kind of contractor or consultant, you may have multiple customers, and you got to swap it out with all of those. And any of those misses, and the old numbers are still in the system. So how do you get 100% coverage, accurate coverage on all of those? What about the introduction of errors when people try to put that in? What about the citizens who don't know their new number? I know my social security number because I've known it for most of my life, and it's just built deep into the oblongatal memory inside my brain. If I had to learn a new social security number, I'd be in big trouble. And so all of that, you know, that is incredibly hard stuff to change. You know, you and I, Jay, have talked, when we talked about quantum cryptography, we have talked about this idea of switching out the fundamental cryptographic models across the world's global PKI and how insanely difficult that is, and it's going to need 10 years to get done. I think this is a much, much harder task than that.
Credit instrument attestation agility.
Yes.
it doesn't exist.
Once again, with your bingo cards, write down, mark that one, because that's the first time we've said that. Absolutely, it doesn't, right? And these systems are old and slow-moving, and they're part of an old offline paradigm, right? They're born in days before there were computers, and they're still structured that way. And yeah, gee, these are tough problems. And this, unfortunately, is a story that is not nearly over.
The analogy that comes to mind right away is this was born in a time when the idea of keeping a secret was holding the cards close to your chest, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. All right. And so while we're talking about downer subjects, let's hit the last one. So, or about, let's say about problems, intractable problems that are continuing to be problems. So interesting cultural bellwether moment, I would say, in the world of phishing is the FBI just put out a notice about SSL certificates in use on phishing sites. So I've blogged in the past, and we may have discussed on this podcast the fact that more than 50% of phishing sites use SSL certificates today. So the FBI just put out a warning just this week, telling people that, basically warning consumers and businesses to be on the lookout for that. And the fact that a site has a certificate and has the padlock does not mean that it's not a phishing site.
I might receive an email that claims to be from PayPal. There's a link on that. Click here, and that link will bring me to a URL. It'll be paypal.something.com.
Right.
If I'm the bad guy, the bad guy merely has to own that domain, something.com, and perhaps put an SSL certificate on that domain, subdomain. Yeah. And then what you're going to see is when you browse with your browser to that site, the site will say secure if there's an SSL certificate.
And now that domain validation is free and trivially easy to get, yep, there's no good reason. If I want to make a phishing site and there's a not secure warning for people who visit me in Chrome or soon in Firefox, and the next version 70 of Firefox is going to have a not secure warning similar to what Chrome has today. If I want to get rid of that, then I just should get a free certificate and stick it on my site. And so what do you know? They are.
The word secure, Tim, right? Secure and not secure.
Yeah.
I think is something we were talking about before, where I still bump into a lot of sites that do not have any form of SSL certificate. Quite often they're government or education based. You might go to a university website looking for research. The one that I go to quite often is Province of Ontario Forestry and Forest Fire Management websites, that just because of where I live, I check these things out. And a lot of them don't have SSL certificates. And I see the great big not secure.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, I very carefully typed in the web address. I know exactly where I am. And so therefore, there's an awful lot of people who on their daily basis aren't sophisticated, you know, security users who are confused, you know, secure, not secure. I go to a phishing site, it says secure. I go to a government site, it's not secure. What the heck does that mean?
Yeah. And this is one of the things that worries me. I understand that if you're a product manager for a browser, that you might say my definition of secure is that information is encrypted using TLS version 1.2 or higher, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, fine. That's your definition. I fear that the ordinary consumer equates the word secure to the word safe. And those two points, encrypted and safe, are absolutely not synonymous. And these not secure messages and these padlocks and all the rest don't necessarily communicate all the nuance that the consumer really should understand.
It certainly does not. And especially when you compare that to extended validation certificates,
right,
where in browsers such as Safari and others, you see a color change as well as the name of the company. Now, all these kinds of visual indicators of, oh, I'm actually at the real PayPal. I'm at the real bank. I'm at the real government institution. So this is a way of actually showing identity associated, and that identity, of course, being having been validated by a certificate authority.
Right.
That's a long way from just the word secure, which you and I, Tim, both understand. It's just the fact that it's SSL encrypted. That doesn't mean that it's not sourced from a very bad source.
Right, exactly. And so You know, obviously, to that degree, that isn't news. And certs on phishing sites is not news. But what is news, of course, is when the FBI makes this kind of announcement that shows something about the scope and scale of it. And the fact that it's getting attention at that level is noteworthy. When the FBI put out its announcement about business email compromise a few years ago, basically put BEC into our vocabulary. Prior to that, people weren't talking about BEC, and after that, they were. So that's an example of the power of those announcements. And, you know, just like I said, it's a cultural bellwether moment.
I think what's happening, Tim, the age of phishing sites is going down and down as phishing campaigns are extremely targeted, extremely fast. The velocity at which these bad guys, these people who do the phishing, are able to spin up brand new domains and subdomains and automatically take free DV certificates and to enable that word secure in the browser. That whole concoction right now of capability that's in the hands of the bad guys, plus the fact that phishing still works so well. This is what's prompted the FBI to talk about it explicitly.
Yeah, you want to talk about intractable problems. You know, phishing was happening in the 1990s and it's still happening now. So it's a 20-year-old attack. So just wrap your head around that. And I'm sure we'll talk about phishing a lot more because it's not going away anytime soon. But those are some big items. I wanted to make sure that we covered them in the news and keep everybody current. So thank you very much, Jay, as always.
Thank you so much for having me, Tim.
All right. Thanks, everybody. This is Root Causes.